It's Wednesday, September 10th, 2014, and you're listening to episode 351 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 46 minutes.
Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
And this is Brodor.
Got two people here with me, obviously. Julie was going to join us, but last minute had to call it off for a reason that may also have me sounding a little funny on this episode. Right now, the Midwest is having this outbreak of kind of an unusual strain of something called the enterovirus. For someone like me, it's just like a chest cold. Now, of course, this is a lot of fun on top of the fact that I've already got the throat problems from the LPR, so now I have an infection as well. But for someone like her, who's a very, very serious asthmatic, this could literally hospitalize or even jeopardize her life. So she has to stay away from me, which is fine. Usually people have to stay away from Chris, or Chris has to stay away from them, typically about 1,500 yards, you know. He can't live near a school. He knows the restrictions better than I do. He has to walk around, pass out leaflets to the neighborhood, explaining who he is, where he lives, what he's done.
Yeah, see, for me, it's just swollen lymph nodes and this gnarled, just nasty, looks like I got punched in the mouth by an ogre, cold sore on my lip.
Yeah, the
I
mean, fun thing about cold sores is cold sores, they call them cold sores, the same reason that they call the fish mahi-mahi, though that's not its proper name. Its proper name is dolphin.
Or herpes.
Yeah.
That's
and
I
in
have.
Your case, there's a marketing campaign that was done, and cold sores, which are actually herpes simplex 1 infections, got called cold sores because walking around telling everyone you have herpes, everyone immediately assumes you're talking about herpes simplex 2 or general herpes. And so being able to say you have herpes. This is a great segue to no topic.
My dangle is perfectly clean except for freckles. I mean, it's got some freckles on it, which is a really trippy thing.
That is odd because I have freckles everywhere but there.
No, my dangle's got them, man. I mean, I'll show you someday. But, you know, and it's funny when you sent me that email response, Dan, about how herpes is contagious, et cetera, et cetera. You know, my wife and I have been together for 22 years and she's never once gotten a cold sore from me. But she does have anal warts.
Right. So
segue away from that one.
Yes. Wow. Okay. I was even going to say something so nice about this dice bag I'm holding. Now it's like I feel like an a-hole for, we're segueing from herpes and butt warts.
I'm just kidding, by the way. My wife does not have anal warts.
Okay. I appreciate that because I didn't know. I don't know how confessional you are.
That's funny, too. On the drive over, I was thinking about how cathartic this experience is. And when I'm being recorded and we're hanging out, it's like there's no one else in the world.
Sure.
Right? It's just this private little confessional. So I'd say that I would be embarrassed that, oh, they recorded that? Oh, man. But yeah, you know.
Yeah. You see, you guys can get away with that. Because of the fact that you don't have to deal with the community reaction. Now, it's never been problematic with you, Brodor. They like you. But what I'm saying is I've been through saying enough things and getting called out on them that I'm very well aware of the fact that I am speaking into a microphone with only two other people and a couple dogs in the room. But I know damn well that within 24 to 48 hours, this is going to be consumed by some X number of people.
And the community might interact with our wives.
Right. Well, see, I learned a very, very important philosophy when I was a child on the playground. And that was the whole concept of sticks and stones.
Yeah.
And the sounds that I make with my mouth that happen to be formed by the words in my mind, they really aren't going to hurt anybody. And if you don't like it, don't fucking listen.
You know, and you're 100% right. And there's a much larger issue I could tie us into that I won't because of no politics on this podcast.
Sure, sure.
And there's no way I could mention the subject without freaking blowing this thing sky high. But what I will say is this is, I think, where there's another distinction because you manage the fantasy shop chain. You hope someday to buy the chain. But the point is that you're on the track to, you know, what it is you want.
Mm-hmm.
See, I've got these ambitions to do other things, you know, get books out there and stuff. And so I need popular momentum. I need people to like me, you know, or at least not despise me. controversy would not help me.
Now, see, that, and that's the thing about me as an individual. And all through high school, I mean, I wanted so much to be liked. I wanted so much for people to find me interesting and want to hang out with me. And it wasn't until I got a little bit older that I realized, you know, I'm quite a divisive person. And some people like me and some people don't. And I figured, you man, life's too short for me to apologize for who I am. So screw, take
it. Yeah, I've taken kind of a different tact. Which is, I don't deceive anybody. You know, when I'm on this show, I'm not fake about who I am. I don't sit here and BS about who I am or what I believe. There is a little bit of persona, and that sometimes I'll take on a viewpoint. I don't exactly hold just for the sake of argument, but what you're hearing here is 90 some odd percent who I really am. But I choose more of this selective honesty that I will only tell the truth up to a certain point, at which point I say, eh, this is just going to divide people or piss people off without really contributing anything to the show. You know, I'm just trolling the audience at this point. And so it's like, okay, I'm going to turn away from that and find something else to say. But actually, when we first started, one of the things that made our show was very existence a little bit divisive was the fact that we came into the podcasting scene when the real trend among podcasters was that gaming podcasts are about our love of the hobby. And so everything is really just somewhere on a scale of good. And we were the first show, or one of the first shows, to really make a regular habit out of saying, we like this, we don't like this. You know, here's a game and we think it sucks. We wouldn't play it.
So you guys came on the air and you said, Rifts blows and D20 is just a copy of GURPS.
No, really. Our thing was more Rifts. Chad had an opinion on Shadowrun that somehow became the show's opinion.
So that's not the show's opinion.
No.
Okay.
It's never been the show's opinion, but somehow Chad said it and John kind of backed it up. And now John's even changed his mind after he's played Shadowrun. But no, that's somehow held up as a truth of the show. We did actually riff off that ourselves in one of our Power 16s, which is where we would put various icons of the show or gaming against each other. We had leagues, and one league was actually run by the creator of Shadowrun, Don Shadowrun. that's his name after him, you know, just whatever.
See, I feel like the show is blossoming into a bonus episode, and we're not even going to get to the topic. Because, like, I feel like I'm on LSD, and I'm looking at a Georgia O'Keeffe, and I think it's a vagine, but it might be a flower, but it's blooming.
No, dude, let me save you that.
It's blooming into something beautiful any which way.
That's the acid. They're all vaginas. All right? Let me demystify that for you.
No, I'm on board. I get it.
I know. If you've ever seen the movie Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Unfortunately, I wasn't sober.
Yeah. And see, no flower in there is a flower. Okay.
No, it's true. And the only person that likes Vagine more than me was Georgia O'Keeffe.
You say, was she dead?
I don't know. I just assume.
I don't think she is.
I just assume. I mean,
okay. Because I was actually outside her studio, but now, admittedly, that was like in 1997. So, yeah, maybe she is. I don't know.
I've been told so many times by listeners that one of the things they love about this show is how we're open books and how open we are. And now they've just listened to this whole conversation. And this is what you get.
Oh, I don't want to shamelessly plug the beer podcast that I'm on. But if you listen to The Hippest of Hops, it's this, but I'm dialed to 11 and I'm probably drunk.
I do tend to get a little more honest on other shows. Still not full both barrels. But it's not even really me as a person. I'm the sort of person that even if you talk to me, I rarely just open up. I mean, I'm a fairly middle road to a lot of things. That really is who I am, that I don't see black or white, except in, I mean, really serious moral issues. I mean, I really do see most of the world somewhere, to dust off one of my old chestnuts here, somewhere in a shade of gray. I mean, I really do think in most issues, both sides have some bit of truth behind them. And, you know, I may think one side's 99, the other side's 1, but that's still a percentage of truth that I have to give them a nod for.
So that's the other comment I hear a lot, is that when people meet us in person at a con or something, that we are the same people in person that we are on the mics. We're exactly like they imagined, except for Chad. The hair.
Well, except Chad.
Yeah.
People expect Chad to be much more abrasive than he is. He's actually, in person, really mellow and really easy to get along with. But everyone, because he's so opinionated on the show, he's so boisterous. And so people expect when they meet him that he's just going to be this really aggressive, you know, sort of person. And he's not.
He's a peach of a man. And when I first met him, we had a complete bromance.
You guys did.
It was fantastic. Yeah. I will say this, though.
It was a little disturbing.
Anyone in the audience who doubts or has their suspicions that you guys are different off the show, no, I can completely say, as a substitute fill-in occasionally on the show guy, knowing you outside the show, you're definitely the genuine article.
The only difference is we don't cuss as much on the mics.
Right.
Except Pat.
Yeah. I think
Pat actually cusses more on the mics than he does off the mic. I really do. I genuinely, honestly do. So, okay, let me say something nice now. This is like the reverse of a compliment sandwich.
That is a beautiful bag you're holding.
It is, yeah. So, okay, I got this scale mail dice bag made for me by Heather Phillips. And she's got a studio called Silver Scales Art Studio. And she does a bunch of stuff. But her big thing is these scale mail dice bags. And I took this out of the box the other day, and Carla took it from me because she's much more into crafts. I suck at arts and crafts, and I have no patience for them. But Carla really loves that stuff. She took it from me, and using whatever chick magic, she was able to like look at the inside, like, oh, this isn't crochet. This is knit. Like, the knit's like through the individual pieces of scale, and this is like a lot of work and high quality. And I just took her word for that, you know, because I don't have any freaking idea what I'm looking at. All I can tell you is this is a cool dice bag. Yeah,
Dan, I've been using mine for over a year now. It's held together better than any dice bag I've ever used. And I'm hard on dice bags.
Yeah, and you guys know, I mean, we don't do commercials on this show. I mean, we don't accept any money. This show's done at a loss. If we talk about something on the show that we say we like, it really is because we like it. FASA is not paying us from beyond the grave. And new FASA doesn't have any of the properties we really cared about. But yeah, I mean, this is a damn nice. And it's a black yarn bag that's got like these like nylon cords to it. And then it's got this these metal, dark green metal scales, which was the color I picked. They let me pick my colors.
Yeah, mine was, mine's red and blue for Superman.
Yeah, I just chose dark green to make it look like dragon scale. Or I don't know what.
No, it looks beautiful.
Yeah, it looks really good.
Well, and the design looks excellent because, and I'm just speculating here, but it looks to me that if you have a lot of dice in that bag, the way the bottom is designed, that will actually sit flat like a cup.
Yeah, it is. It is indeed sewn that way. Yeah, it's shaped like a cup, not like a pouch or something like that. So, yeah, anyway, check that stuff out. If you're at all interested in that kind of stuff, get in touch with Heather. Once again, that's Silver Scales Art Studio, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes. I'll post both a link to her stuff on Facebook, which is where she wants to be contacted, or I guess does most of her contacts. But I'll also include a picture in the show notes of the dice bag that she made for me, just so you have some idea of what the product looks like, you know, and you don't think she's just dressing this up or whatever on her site. I mean, it really is good stuff. So
she knows who the good hosts are because we both have them.
I know.
Wow.
She has excellent taste. So, All right.
So here's the deal. Long story short, I've been doing a lot of reading, and I don't mean to sound pretentious gamer guy.
Yeah, because you've been reading?
Yeah.
Wow. Slow down there, Einstein. So
I've read a lot of books.
I picked up a book.
In the last couple of years, like I want to genuinely be a good game master. Right. I want to run good games. I want it to be fun. I want it to be exciting. I want it to be entertaining. And I want people to pay me to do it. So I want to have good craft. And I've read a number of books in the last few years about gaming and game mastering, and they all have great tips and great ideas for how to run your games and deal with your players. And one of the common themes among them is they all have these classifications for the type of player.
Sure.
This guy is the rules lawyer. This chick is the drama whore. Or that dude's the drama whore. Or that guy is the munchkin, and this guy wants this sort of game, right? And, you know, some people are lumps. They just want to be led around by the nose, right?
This and is the person they can't tell the difference between herself and her character.
Right.
And then there's the one guy that always plays the damn dex thief.
Or the elf wizard, Mark Calderola. Elf wizard, no more. Never again. You never get to play one again. But anyway, I was thinking that, okay, this is all pretty interesting, and obviously those elements are reflected in who you are as a game master. If you like the drama in the game and it's mostly about role play and you're very into, you know, classic World of Darkness, that's going to be reflected in your game. If you're a rules lawyer and you like the crunch and you want to have all of that going on, obviously that's going to impact the kind of game that you run. But I don't know if anyone's ever classified or done styles of game master. So I started thinking about my group and the two people who primarily game master in my group, myself and my buddy Anthony, and how would I classify us as game masters? And it's just sort of got me thinking about So who are we and where do we fall in line? If I can say so-and-so is a rules lawyer, this guy's X kind of game master.
Given the age of the RPG hobby and the amount of pedantry that exists within our hobby, I have no doubt somebody has done this before. I have not personally come across it. I'm sure somebody will post a link to something in the show notes where somebody's already done this. I've personally not come across it.
And I would say this is different than the series of Game Master styles
right,
that For
right.
the Boot did.
Right, right, exactly.
So don't post a link back to us because this isn't the same thing.
Well, that would be funny, but let's do a zero to publish part three. Let's do that again. But no, it's certainly when I look at what's out there, I have seen a ton of different tests, diagrams, classification schemes, and some of them are made using overlapping spheres of interest. Some of them have axes. There's the fairly well-known, was a GSN one of gamist, simulationist, narrativist, I think is are the three axes on that. And there is a lot of material out there dissecting the player, and there's certainly not nearly as much dissecting the Game Master.
No, I've only seen the Game Master broken down into two categories, planner and improv.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, or put on that one scale.
Yeah.
It's a one axis of complete improv on one side, I'm running out of a module on the other, and you fall somewhere in the middle.
Okay, so here's my example, and this is going to end a friendship. So my buddy Anthony, whom I've been gaming with since the late 1990s, brilliant guy, great writer, wonderful storyteller, but he's a director. You have your part and there's a little bit of deviation that you're allowed, but ultimately, look, this is my vision and I want you to adhere to my vision, to the point where he and I have fought at the table. I mean, at one point in a Shadowrun game, I pushed my character across the table and I'm like, fine, man, you tell me what I do.
I did the exact same thing. I had a game master where I had the exact same thing happen. And, you know, I would call them storyteller GMs because of the fact that all they want to do is sit there and tell a story.
Right.
But I don't want to use that phrase because storytelling GMing is actually already in use and it means something completely different. But yeah, I think calling them like a movie director or a novelist or something like that is completely accurate. I had the exact same experience, which is part of how I got my whole golden box around the character sheet. I don't want people to touch my character. Was because it did reach a point where he would narrate out what I was doing, how it was turning out. I wasn't getting to roll dice. I wasn't getting to declare actions. And if I declared an action that wasn't within the scope, wasn't exactly a railroad, but it was more like he had these parameters of what was and wasn't acceptable within the game. And if I messed with one of his Baron von Badasses or something, you know, I just, whatever. And there did come a point where I had that exact same, where I just put up my hands and said, why don't you tell me what I do and what happens? I mean, let me just sit back here. Let's just take away any pretense. This isn't a game. You want to tell me a story? And you know what? It's not a bad story. I'm okay with that. But right. can we ditch the pretense here?
And here's the shocking thing. It's like the person who cuts you off and then looks at you like you're the asshole. I'm like, wait a minute, you wronged me.
Yeah.
But we've had a number of exchanges like that. But he's a U-Bowl kind of director. Like, he'll whoop my ass on top of everything else. You know, you go to U-Bowl because you don't like his movies and he'll whoop your ass. You know, Anthony whooped my ass.
Yeah, he selectively picked his fights. He actually refused to fight the one guy that could have probably kicked his ass.
Fair enough.
I've seen the exact opposite of this.
Okay.
I don't know what to call this GM style other than Chad, but the guy that...
Hey, that's my man crush.
That's true. But the guy that you'll be playing a game and you'll be looking for, okay, what am I going to find clue-wise? You know, you finally break your way in somewhere, you've got the clue, and he'll turn to you and say, okay, what does it say?
Oh, wow.
Well, that is interesting in a certain kind of game. Me as a gamer, what I want is to discover your plot, not to write your plot.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. I think my creation versus I'm taking your input is certainly one of the axes we could create for a game master. How much of this is my creation or something I brought to the table, such as a pre-written module, versus I want your input? And that's certainly one great axis, because you have people on the far extreme who they've written it all. They're going to tell you everything that happens. You might as well just put the dice and pencil down and just listen. To people like Chad, where he comes into the game with pants, and that's about it.
Yep. Chad has said it is a successful game for him if he doesn't have to speak for an hour and a half.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's certainly one of them. I think another one I'd look at is how strict is the person with the rules? Do the rules apply to the game master? Will they kill your character? Or is it more kind of the rules are here to enable a story all the way out to I don't like rules? You know, with maybe somewhere toward that end, you have the roll high and if it looks good, we'll go with it. All the way out to the people who are like, I don't even want dice at the table.
Right.
You know, we're just going to come. So, I mean, there might be kind of a rules axis to this.
I wonder where I would fall in the rules axis, because I've always been of the mindset, and I'm kind of getting away from this now. I've been of the mindset since I started GMing that I hold myself to the highest accountability when it comes to rules, and I let it slide for the players.
I'm on board. I like that. I would make the comment that for me, the importance of the rules depends on the game. Like, I'm running a Pathfinder campaign currently, and I would say that rules are 85% important in Pathfinder. So there's, I've got a 15% wiggle room. But I'm also running a Savage Worlds game, and I'm like, nah, I'm 50-50 on that, man. I mean, you know, we could just come up with something. Hey, I'm going to try agility in this and take that penalty and get there sort of thing. Yeah, so,
well, I'm the same way. On a Pathfinder game, I'm watching the rules a lot closer.
Right.
On a Fate game, like a Dresden game, even though it's already rules light, I still let the rules slide on that a lot.
Well, and I think certainly nobody's going to fit one paradigm in every situation. I mean, what you're going to be looking for is trends. Even you look at somebody who's like, as a player, really high into abstract narrative, that's not how they're going to play a war game or a board game. I mean, they might bring a story element to it. I mean, that's something Chad and I do all the time, is we try to see an emergent story in the board games we play. But the fact is, you can't put that aside and play. I mean, so there's always going to be context to it. I think another axis that I would add is, how adversarial are they? I think on one extreme, you have the game masters where their goal is to kill the group, and the group's goal is to find every hole in the rules they can to screw the game master. And once again, this typically happens in newer groups, but I have seen some groups where this is how they continue. Maybe backing off that seal a little bit, you get the people who jokingly, but not quite jokingly, talk about how they get off on TPK and their players when they annoy them. And then all the way onto the other side, you have start to have people where I want to challenge my players, but in the end, I want them to win. I'm on their side. All the way out to perhaps some of these people who play deep in the sandbox, where really they want to see everything the characters do succeed. And they're only going to put enough stuff in their way to create a story.
So I heard someone the other day say something that I don't know that I 100% agree with, but at least in the 90%. And it's that a really good GM will be cheering for the players on the player's side, and the players will think that he's out to get them.
Yeah, I'm with you, Wayne. I, in the high 90s, if not 100%, would agree with that. That is typically how I run my games. I guarantee you, the scene I am working towards is the climactic fall of whatever the evil is in the world at the hands of the players. But I'm going to make them feel like they stand no chance, because I love underdog stories. I'm a big fan of underdog stories. Now, if we talk about specific traits, just like you have the rules lawyer, let's start talking about some types of GMing I hate. Obstructionist GMs. I mentioned this a podcast or two back. The game master, where they don't have a plot, they just have a series of obstructions. It's not like, you know, you're going to go from here to there, and along the way, you're going to encounter these things and these contortions of the plot and all this interesting clues and stuff. It's just more like, you got to get the MacGuffin. Well, we try to start the car. Car has no gas. Okay, we go to the gas station. Zombie apocalypse. Gas station has no gas. Okay, we finally find a gas can. Well, there's a starving orphan that needs that gas can. So if you take that gas can, instead of them dying warm and from carbon monoxide or whatever, you're going to take it. So now you have to find something else to give them so they can die from carbon monoxide from another source. You know, whatever.
Well, and I shoot the orphan.
Yeah. And I have played under game masters who have done this, where it's like, you're not giving me a plot. You're just obstructing me.
Right.
It's just whatever I do, you're just going to keep dragging this out. And it's absolutely enraging.
See, and here's where I will. And when we were corresponding via email, one of the things that I said for my classification of GM is that I would say that I'm the improv entertainer. I really make it my goal at the table that everybody's having fun and you're entertained and you're engaged. And sometimes to my own detriment. But one of the things that I ask myself in a situation like that, if I was game mastering, I would say, how is this interesting to the players? How are they going to engage with this? How do they find it interesting? How does it further their development or to further the plot of the campaign? And that kind of crap doesn't.
Have any of you played under the overly clever GM? And by that, I mean the guy who's not even slightly clever, but everything he does is the most wonderful thing in the world. And wait till you see what I have in store for you this week.
Yes, and usually in the form of something we talked about way back in our show run, the Tour de Realms GM, where they read a few novels or read a source book, and they just fell head over heels for this setting. And all they want you to do is basically sit on a tram and ride through the zoo and ooh and ah at all the wonderful characters and places they're in love with. And it's like, okay, and my place in this world is what now? Yeah, I came here for my story. Our story, if you want to call it that, fine.
Right.
Sure, shit ain't your story.
Right.
I mean, if you want, you've got your story, you want me to tell and you want me to consume it, great, write a novel. I've read lots of novels. Those are the word books you've seen, mm-hmm. Mike, just that you've been trying to get more into. Yeah. There's stuff above Shel Silverstein.
Oh, man. I love Shel Silverstein. I
mean, you see a picture of him. He's the scariest looking human being on the face of the earth.
He's going to pull up in his Harley. I come to read your kids a story.
If I put a picture of Shel Silverstein over your bed, you would never sleep. It'd be like that Simpsons episode, you know. Can't sleep, Shel will eat me. Can't sleep,
Shel will eat me. Oh, now it's a challenge. Now I'm going to go home. I'm going to take a Shel Silverstein book, and I'm going to see if I can tug one out.
I'm going to tug one out. All right, we're going to do something we don't normally do. But so I'm going to edit out a break in the recording while I go get a picture of him. All right, so here we go. This is the first ever Fear the Boot live reaction. This is like reaction videos to Two Girls, One Cup, okay? So right here we got The Giving Tree, right? You know,
right.
Good book. This is actually one of the books that's really heavily influenced my life and personal philosophy. I love this book, okay? Great book. You ready?
Yeah. I mean, seriously, I think I need a tampon for my anus because that is rapey. I mean, that is, I'm going to razor blades for a week, rapey. Well, and he looks sort of monosyllabic, like I'm surprised he can pick up a pencil, you know? It's crazy. Yeah, I'm totally going to try to rub one out.
Let me know how that goes. If you succeed, I worry more about you than I do him. Because for whatever he looks like, this is this man's thoughts, okay? You know, very beautiful, deep stuff, all right? The Giving Tree is an extremely simple book, but I think has a really, really good message a lot of people would say and learn from. That's what's on his mind. Rubbing one out to this face, that takes a far darker mind.
It's a challenge, right? Like, I totally don't think
like
I can do
this
it.
Should be a World of Darkness supplement.
Like, every time you flip the book over, I have an innie.
Yeah, I mean, this man, she should have his own. I don't even know what it would be. Shel Silverstein, the rubbing out? I don't know what it would be.
That's it. In my gore game at Fear the Con 8, like, Shel Silverstein is going to be sort of what's the wizard's name in Shazam that Billy Batson has to go seek?
Shazam.
Okay, oh, so the old wizard Shazam. He's going to be my Shazam to Gore. Like, Gore's going to be having a bad day, and they're going to go to Shel Silverstein. Of course, he's going to be...
He should have no... He should be, like, a really nice guy, have a lot of social skills, be really, you know, gentle and all this kind of stuff. But for no reason anyone can discern, there's like this aura of DC 25 horror that surrounds him.
And I can see him in like a... Even though
everywhere he steps, flowers spring up.
just the horrors of hell, like the darkest parts of the abyss. But I see him and he's like, he's in a dashiki, but it's sort of a half dashiki. So his belly's there. He's wearing like a pink thong and go-go boots. And that's like my Shel Silverstein.
Wow. And somewhere out there, that slash fic exists on the internet. Anyway, so... Things we don't like in GMs. I'm going to push your buttons.
All right.
No. That's the trait.
Oh.
You ever had, and I've never had to deal with this, but we get horror stories fairly often on Fear the Boot. And on the times that we've been over there on Happy Jacks, and we need to get another one of those crossovers set up, because those are always a lot of fun.
Just because I want to read a horror story.
Yeah, but doing their horror stories and some of the emails we've gotten, man, we've heard about a lot of game masters where, oh no, I take this back. I have encountered this once. I won't name the person, not affiliated with Fear of the Boot. Once again, just not trying to use this as a bully pulpit. And this was some years ago, and I hope he has grown as a person since then. This is not cool, period. If you're doing this, stop doing this. But he had in his group, it was a bunch of males, including me, and one female. And he starts trying to describe the scene. I don't remember the details. It's some kind of D&D game, and we'd fall into some kind of darkness or something like that. And we're all going through these like weird like nightmares and visions and such. Mm-hmm. And like, there's one girl player, and he starts going on about how you're getting raped. It's like one man after another. It starts going, and I won't repeat all this. I know some people get really touchy about the subject, and I understand why, despite the things that Broder just joked about. But
Oh, I'm going to take it real dark in a minute.
But he got fairly graphic. I mean, he certainly could have gotten worse, but I don't think he needed to be there at all. And then he just kind of sits there and has this like smirk on his face, like he's waiting for a reaction. Mm-hmm. And she was like, what the fuck? And all of us were kind of like, dude, that ain't right. But I've seen this, though, a lot more in the emails we get, mm-hmm. where people have a game master where it's like, you know what? I want my game to be visceral. I want my game to have a reaction. I want you to really feel my game. Mm-hmm. And Wayne, as a game master, that's one of my big goals, is I accept I'm the slow game GM. You may not have that damn moment until 3 to 5 games in, and I'm mm-hmm. okay with that.
Right.
I'm okay with the long prologue leading up to a big payoff. But there are people who want to elicit that same emotional reaction without investing the same kind of energy into either an interesting quick hit or an interesting slow build. And they try to do it by basically saying, whatever your issue is, I'm going to bring that into the game just so it hits home. So for Wayne, we're going to have a scene where, you know, they're torturing puppies. And for Pat, we're going to be killing kids. And for this person, somebody's going to rape you. I mean, look, this is bullshit. If that's how you game masters, by screwing with people's actual human psyches in a negative way, I'm not talking about, hey, I know Wayne will find this funny. I'm not talking about that kind of playing with their psyche. If you're actually trying to disturb someone on the real level of things that they have had problems with, you are f***ed up.
I'm sorry, Wayne, you were going to say something. I don't want to step on your toes.
I was just going to say, there's not as bad as that. When you said button pressing, I was thinking the other side of that. The GM that knows the weakness of every one of the characters and just constantly hits it.
Either in role play or in rules. I've seen that as well.
What if what you've described, Dan, I did on accident?
I didn't plan it. Everybody makes mistakes. You did it on accident.
Oh.
It wasn't your intention.
Oh, no.
And you're not. Dude, we've gotten emails from people where they had GMs who get off on this and they had to leave groups over it. Or in some cases, unfortunately, they didn't have the social fortitude or whatever to say stop or leave the group.
Okay. And I walked right up to the line, and I won't bore anyone with the gaming story, but in a D&D game I ran for a long time, I had two moments. One moment where there was a little bit of revulsion, but later in the campaign, a moment where literally my wife, she's got tears in her eyes, and my buddy's wife won't look at me. But I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't like seek out to, I'm going to offend you, I'm going to have something so terrible because I've specifically planned it. I just have this terrible thing that you witness. And it wasn't anything like that, but it was so bizarre and descriptive that they were very uncomfortable with it. But I didn't do it on purpose, and it didn't end the game.
You know, that's just an awesome roleplay moment. You step on landmines sometimes. As a GM, you don't know everyone's hot buttons. If you run a lot of con games, you really don't know their hot buttons. Everyone will eventually hit a landmine that they don't intend to.
Sure. And that's fine. It's not fine. But my point is, people make mistakes. If you make a mistake and you learn from it and wasn't your intention and there's good communication, it's all great. I'm talking about the GMs who get off on it, where that is their plan. Is I'm not going to get you with my plot or my NPCs. I'm going to get you by making this real to you. And the way I'm going to make it real to you is I'm going to find whatever your traumas are, whatever your hot button issues are, whatever the subjects are you're passionate about. And I'm just going to do this for the sake of eliciting a response. And it's like, no, that's cheap.
Okay.
You know, that's cheap.
Yeah, see, so me
and it's horrible, but it's also cheap.
No, I agree. But for me as a game master, it's, I don't know, it's going to sound so douchey, but I'm very zen with my game mastering, right? Like, I just go. Here's the story, and I'm going to go. And the players react, and I'm going to go. And basically, it's just this constant dance of back and forth. But even though it's their story, I'm still going to take you in a trip through my mind and through my imagination. And so something that I think is dark and horrible, without polling you, without really understanding what it is that you think is dark and horrible, this is just the thing that was in my mind. And sometimes I get a reaction that I didn't intend or that's a little too visceral.
And I had the same thing happen actually not that long ago. Now that I think about it, it was in the Skies of Glass game. And I had no idea I was walking into somebody's issue. But there was a fairly graphic killing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't graphic. It wasn't like I just carried out the details for half an hour. It wasn't like that. But usually in role-playing games, the act of killing something that's fairly detached, which we could probably do a whole episode on that alone. Mm-hmm. But the killing of something that's fairly detached, you roll some numbers, maybe do a little bit of RP or description, but you really don't get too deep into the ramifications of it. But Skies of Glass as a game is meant to feel a little more real. You know, you don't have hit points, you have injuries, you have infections. You know, mm-hmm. it's meant to create a sense that your character is a person, not just a bunch of stats. And there was a scene, and I won't go into a huge gaming story on this, but there was a scene where a guy had been leading a town, and he got killed, and his second-in-command steps forward. Mm-hmm. But his second-in-command didn't quite have power over the town, because even though he was officially a second-in-command, there was this kind of mover and shaker who had been manipulating situations. And so while the group was standing there, he said, you know, I want you guys to know this is a new age of unity and direction for our town, and we're going to do this and this and this, and a bunch of plot stuff that mm-hmm. would be irrelevant to when it wasn't there. And he calls this person up, and the players have this image like they're going to shake hands and make cool. And when the person walks up, he takes out a knife, slits their throat, throws them to the ground, and just stands there until they bleed out. And they says, and that's what happens to any of you who don't agree with my plan or want to f*** with me.
Wow.
Now, he's not a good person. He's mm-hmm. not meant to be a good person. Skies of Glass is a very morally gray universe, leaning towards the darker ends of gray.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the point of the game is that you're trying to be something more positive. Not everybody's dark and evil. You know, you find light spots in the game. You find good people in the game. But part of that point of the game is kind of how do you operate in a world that's, I mean, what's the quote from Batman? You know, the Joker says is they're only as good as society allows them to be or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of that's what it's about is that, I mean, not it's not the, quite the world of darkness beast within, but the idea is that humanity doesn't have society that allows us to not see the cow that we killed for dinner. It does. It's a very hands-on sort of world where all these social veneers and the sterility we've created for ourselves, it isn't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And ugly things are done out in the open. But my point being, it really bugged one of the players. I mean, one of the players was like, that was just too real. There was no, that I'm aware of, no issue there. It wasn't like this person, you know, like their father had their throat slit or something like that. But it was just, it disturbed them. As soon as it got to me, because the person was kind of afraid to approach me, because this was the first game that I had with them. And like, I don't know how he's going to respond to it. I don't want to upset him. And I don't want to derail the group. And I don't want to be responsible for killing the game. But this player told another player, and then that player came and told me. And I immediately said, whoa, this player has nothing to worry about. They have nothing to be upset about or ashamed about. If I stepped on a real issue for them, then I'm in the wrong. I may not have meant to be in the wrong, but I'm in the wrong. Because the point of my game was not to upset you as a human being. Yes, it was supposed to be a graphic scene. Yes, if everyone here is hearing that noise, we're in the middle of a thunderstorm while recording this. But yes, it was meant to be a graphic scene. Yes, it was meant to be visceral. Yes, it was meant to kind of give everyone that kind of damn sort of moment. But it was not meant to actually upset anyone like that. I mean, you walk away from the table genuinely upset by things that have happened on a personal level. That's not what I was trying to do. That's not the kind of GM I am. And so we immediately changed directions, and I told that person, I said, you have nothing to be ashamed of. And I said, in the future, if I ever step on an issue, you need to tell me up front. I'm not going to berate you. I'm not going to belittle you. But I don't always know. Mm-hmm. You know, I know the big ones. I mean, okay, obviously there are things we're just not going to do in a role-playing game. But right. I don't know everything. But once again, I play with the GMs who don't care. That's their goal, is they just want to mess you up. And it's like, no, that's...
So, Dan, you said you're not that kind of GM. What kind of GM are you? Brodor gave his example of what he thinks he would be.
Ta-da! I would describe myself as being pro player, but I like to make them work for it. I come with prep, but I want player input, and this is a critical thing here, not just during the game, which I do my best to respond to, but I desperately need player input prior to writing my plot. Because of the fact that I'm investing in a long-term game, I need to know that when the hits happen, they matter. I need to know I'm dealing with issues that the characters care about. And so I need a lot of player input, especially before we get deep into the game. Ideally, even before the first game. I rely very much on player feedback. I tend to be very uncertain of myself. I am not at all adversarial. Once again, while I may have that illusion of being adversarial because of the fact that I want the game to feel like an underdog fight, the players will always win out in the end. They will always win out in the end. I've never made any secret of the fact that my biggest weakness as a GM is that oftentimes things are obvious to me that are not obvious to my players. I would have to do a little bit more self-examination and tell you why it is I keep doing that specifically. I think partially because of the fact that I love deep stories. But it's not like I'm a novelist GM. It's not like I'm going to tell you this deep story and I just want you to sit there and consume it. I want you to be a part of it. I want you to change it. I want you to take it in directions I never expected. There's a lot of fluidity. Oh, that was a loud one. There's a lot of fluidity to what I do. But I think because of the fact that the players, sometimes they don't see that fluidity. Maybe they assume they're in a railroad or a box canyon they're not actually in. Maybe because of the fact that I'm writing a certain portion of this in my own head, and that's part of coming prepped. Is there certain things that are obvious or sensible or cogent to me that don't necessarily play out when they actually hit the real world?
So I would consider myself the directorial enabler. The way I typically run, I have my villains, which I say loosely because I will have a big bad that's doing all the plotting and is doing what he's doing. Everyone else, you can kind of get to. Like in the current campaign, they've actually taken potential, you know, villains and they've converted them and brought them into their group. It's happened twice. But basically, I set up situations and I let them run wild. And I may do that a little bit too much, but it seems that if the players are kind of running wild, really enjoying themselves, having fun, then when I get the punch moments, it has more impact. I do a lot of just on the fly. Things go places I never even began to imagine that they would go. But the story is still going. They're still interacting with it. And they still get where I want them to be without me forcing them there at all. It just, that's where they end up.
Okay. I think I have my style in a short phrase. I'm a 23rd Psalm GM. I love my players. I care for them tenderly. I want to take them on a journey that will be ultimately enriching for them, but at times it may be a long journey through dark places to get there. If you read the 23rd Psalm, I'm not claiming I'm God. Okay, don't please, this is blasphemy.
You're getting struck.
If you read the 23rd Psalm, that's kind of what I have in mind for my players. I want to take them through an experience that will be at times not always clear and at times not always pleasant for the characters. I want it to always be pleasant for the players, but it may not always be pleasant for the characters. But in the end, I'm rooting for them. I'm on their side. There is always a way forward, and they will come out of that in the end. Well, this has been an interesting one. You know, I'm going to be really excited to see what our listeners have to add in terms of their own axes or GM traits that they love or hate or whatever, and how they would do this. You know, just I guess one last thing in closing is the dating service you were talking about.
So here's the deal, right? And the symbol for the dating service is no, it's not his face. It's Shel Silverstein's, you know, that pink thong. It's just his big fat moose knuckle with all that hair coming out of the side. Because you know he didn't shave to get in that thing, right? I mean, there's just moose knuckle and afro. It's like a flood. Just a flood of hair coming.
The hell have we?
Right. So anyway, I was thinking.
I want you to know, you're saying this about a man who wrote, and when he was tired, he would sleep in her shade.
Oh, that's very sweet. Well, you know. And that's Hitler was a painter, whatever.
Oh my God.
My point is,
there was Shel Silverstein and Hitler was Shel Silverstein stuck with a heart.
Well, and Hitler did not have a big, enormous moose knuckle. I mean, that dude was compensating for more than just his height. But so anyway, and there are people out there way smarter than me. But I thought there's all these dating services out there.
Yeah.
Instead of doing one specifically for hookups, although I'm sure it would happen. You know, hey, I'm Mike. I live in the St. Louis area in the suburb of Hazelwood, and I like to game, and I've been gaming this long, and these are the games that I enjoy. This is my running style. Would you like to get together and meet? Let's go have coffee and talk about games. So we won't even get into group template. We'll just kind of hang out,
sure,
meet each other, and sort of help form a group,
yeah,
but do it like a dating service.
And I think the problem that a lot of groups have, and perhaps this is why GMs don't get more dissection than they do, is because in many groups, the GM is whoever will do it.
Right.
And so the game masters can sit there all day long wringing their hands about the problems with their players. And maybe that's part of it as well. is the game masters feel like they're in a position where they have to adapt to the players don't have to adapt to them. And so they have to figure out who their players are and how they keep their attention and get their attention, because these players won't do the reasonable thing of trying to meet the game master halfway. And so you have a singular GM who's stuck with a group of players that may or may not have any interest in meeting him or her halfway. And this is why you get the great dissection and vivisection of players and very little discussion about game masters, because players very rarely perhaps even have the opportunity to be picky about their GMs, and certainly don't, at least in many cases, seem to invest themselves in trying to understand and adapt to who their game master is. All right.
Well, and let's face it, the people that take the time to go to forums, listen to podcasts, write books, read books, a lot of them are the GMs to begin with.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about other GMs. We're talking about our players.
So let me throw back to episode 330, GMing the Oldest Profession. Are you, after this discussion, any more persuaded that getting paid to game master is a decent idea?
You know, I'm going to have to keep this right in line with prostitution. Yes, but not for my friends.
Gotcha. Well, because I mean, I'll be an escort, or I will be a filthy, filthy whore. But if you want anal, it's going to cost.
Okay, if anything this show offended you, send your emails to 4chan. As for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in. I hope you have a great week and great games, and Greek if you paid for it. And we will catch you next time. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2014. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.